This is the live audio recording for URS demo, uniform rapid suspension demonstration, going from 115 to 215 in hall 1A.
Welcome, everyone. This is the URS demo session, and we'll get started right away here. So to my left are from ICANN, Krista and Olaf, and I'll let them introduce themselves a little more in detail. And to my right are the two URS providers from Forum who will be doing the demonstration today, and ADN DRC, who will have a PowerPoint slides of their screens that I'll be uploading to the session. This session, the slide, whatever you see here, will be captured and provided to you on the session schedule. Krista, you want to say a word of welcome?
Thanks, Dennis. My name is Krista Papik, and I'm a GTLD Registry Services Director on ICANN staff. I thank you, everyone, for coming to this session, and I don't really have a whole lot to say about myself.
Okay, thank you. My name is Olaf Nordling, and I'm a Senior Director for GAC Relations. What on earth would I do with URS? Well, nothing for the time being. I mean, it's all shifted to Krista, but I was deeply involved in the implementation of that particular system, so that's why I'm here. And I might have to leave early since the GAC is pretty busy right now.
I'm Christine Dorain. I'm the Director of Internet and IP Services for the National Arbitration Forum, URS provider.
Hello, I'm Dennis Chai from the ADN DLC, the Asian Domain Name Dispute Resolution Center. It's also the URS provider.
So my name is Dennis Chang, and I'm the project manager for the URS from ICANN. So we'll get started right away with the demonstration from Christine. I'll turn it over to you. Go ahead.
Great. Thank you. So I was planning to do a fully live presentation today, but my test last night worked, but this morning the connections to the office suddenly died. So they've been watching my phone, and I don't think they're going to get it fixed. So I did prepare a PowerPoint presentation as a backup. So I'm going to kind of be going back and forth between the PowerPoint presentation and the and our website. So I want to start out by, I'm told to get really close to the mic, so I'm trying to make this work here. I want to start out by just telling you, you know, the way to access the URS online filing is to go to our website, policies, rules, forms, and filing over here on the left, scroll down to the policy that you need. In this case, it would be URS. Once you click on that, you'll find some information about the URS. You'll be able to view our frequently asked questions. And here's the link for online filing for URS complaints. Down at the bottom, you'll see instructions for how to file a URS complaint, what you need to gather, all the information you need to have at your fingertips, or if you're going to have file a URS response, the information that you need is there. You can also find links to the URS policy itself, the rules, and the supplemental rules. So now I'm going to switch to the PowerPoint presentation because I don't think that the test environment is going to let me file, but we can try. So when you click on the file a URS complaint, you're allowed to either log in as an existing user or file as a new user. If you need to think about, you don't have to enter your name and your business, but if you enter one or the other, your username is going to be based on whichever you enter. If you enter both, it will be based on your business. So we email you your username, and then you set up your own password. The password link is emailed to you, so you need to watch your email account for that password in order to get your username set up. If you already have one from UDRP, if you already have one from UDRP, you can I'm going to try one more. Oops. Okay, well, we're not going to do that then. If you already have one for UDRP, you can simply use that one as well to just file your complaint. So this PowerPoint is actually set up to go online on our system as being a demonstration. So there's a bunch of information here about filing complaints and about a bunch of preliminary information as well. So like I talked about, here's the login place for signing your or for filling in your username and password or for setting up yourself as a new user. If you want to log in through your portal, and I'll show you a demonstration of the portal in a minute, but if you're already a user, you're already on our portal, you can log into the portal, and then you can click from the portal into the online filing system as well. So here's a screenshot from our portal, and this is your dashboard. You would click over here to New Filing, select URS, and select Begin Filing. So that will get you back to this screen to log in. So those are two different ways you can get into the system, either directly from our website or from your portal. The first screen that you're taken to identifies you as either the complainant or the complainant's representative. And it is all of the certifications that the URS requires. So the URS 1.2.8, Rule 3B9, and Rule 3B10 all have certifications that need to be agreed to before you can file or in order to file a URS complaint. So these are tick boxes. You tick through these asserting that you've agreed to the different terms listed in the URS. The next screen you're taken to is where you're going to enter the domain names at issue. Now, here you can see .com. It's in our test environment, which is where these screens were created. We had to stop the validation process because we had to be able to test with something. So this screen does a lot of validation. You're going to enter your domain name, and it's going to check and make sure that the domain name is validly registered. It's not expired. It's not available for registration. And that it is a new top-level domain or a top-level domain that has adopted the URS in the case of ccTLDs. So currently, if you were to test our system now, you would find that you could only file for .pw domains because .pw has adopted the URS as a country code TLD, and there are no other existing TLDs that have adopted the URS. So you would only be able to file for .pw at this point. I should back up and just tell you, if you log in as an existing user, you can save your session at any point, go away and come back, and it will allow you to re-log in and pick back up where you left off, which is not something UDRP, our UDRP system, allows you to do. Part of that's because there's only like three screens for UDRP, and there's a lot more here. So once you click Save and Continue, a Whois lookup is going to start running in the background. So while that's happening, it wants you to we're going to collect your information and any alternate respondent information that you have. So if you're a registered party and you're already on our website, this page will pre-populate for you. If you don't like what's here because you're going on vacation and you want to be reached at a different number, maybe your mobile number, you can update your information on the screen. It will not permanently update your record with us, or your master record. It will only update your record for this case. All of the other information will remain static. If you want to update your permanent record information at the party level, you can just contact your case coordinator and they can help you do that. But here's where you enter complainant information. If there's more than one complainant, you can click Save and Add New at the bottom here, and it will add another place for you to add another complainant if there are two linked complainants. In some cases, it's a complainant and maybe it's IP holding company or something. Then when you click Next in that case, you'll be presented with a text box, in which you will define how the two complainants are linked. One's IP holding company, they're related, they're subsidiaries. Currently under UDRP, you have to do the same thing. So this is a text box where you tell the panel, this isn't a class complaint, these are two actually related complaining entities. You can also click this checkbox here, and a screen will appear when you click Save and Continue to add respondents or complainants representative information. Now, as I mentioned, there's a Whois lookup being performed in the background, and it's supposed to be pulling and parsing the Whois information. In a perfect world, that's what's going to happen. However, you might, in your investigations, have found alternate contact information for the respondent. So it's important that you can enter that information here if you have it. If you know that complainant has or respondent has a representative, you can add that at the screen. Otherwise, you can skip the alternate respondent information and just go with whatever's in the who is and just click this top button, and it'll just proceed to the next page. Then, as the who is lookup is still performing in the background, we're going to collect the arguments that you're raising. So the URS requires the complaint only be a checkbox form. So that's what this is. It's a checkbox form. You're going to check all of the elements that apply to your complaint. And then you will be presented with the text box you can see at the bottom of the screen. And I think when I click enter, it's going to show the rest of the screen, where you can have your 500 words of explanatory text. And that would be entered on this screen as well. And there's the second half of that screen. Also on this screen, you can see this is the place where you would identify any other legal proceedings as required under the URS. So you could click the box if there's no legal proceedings. Otherwise, you can enter some information describing the nature of, you know, you've had previous, you know, litigation or something going along with this particular party. So now, by the time you get to this page, all of the WHOIS lookups should have been performed. And on the left-hand side of the screen, you'll see a list of all the domain names in the case. And starting with the first one, you're going to enter information based on the for that specific domain name. In this case, we only have one domain name. But we tried testing.com. The registrar that pulled was fabulous. And then you're going to provide your trademark information on the first line, classification, goods and services on the second line, and then you can upload documents. You're going to be allowed to upload three documents per domain name. One is going to be your trademark information, one is going to be your site screenshot, which you have to provide, and then one is going to be your proof of use. For your proof of use, it can be whatever you're going to upload for proof of use. Otherwise, that's where you would upload your trademark clearinghouse SMD file, and just call that, that's your proof of use. So you can upload that there. If you have, for instance, three domain names on this list and they all maybe rely on the same trademark information, that doesn't matter. On the next page, you'll just re-upload that document, so you'll upload that three times. The point of this is to make it super easy for the examiner. We're cutting down the amount of time and money the examiner has for doing these cases. So the point is to make this as simple as possible for the examiner. So they're going to be able to go into their portal, look on a domain name, look for the three documents attached to that domain name, quickly review them, and move on to the next one. And so this is a way of making that a lot easier for the examiner. One of the things that I wanted to make clear in this presentation is that as a result of the fact that, you know, this community wanted the cost significantly lowered, this is turning into somewhat of an automated and self-service system. So that's why you're entering your own case information. Automated emails are going out. Automated WHOIS pages are pulling. And, you're uploading documents, maybe even redundantly, in order to make things a lot easier for the panelists to do their job. At the bottom of the screen, and I'm going to see, I don't remember if I have. Yeah, so this is the bottom half of that same screen. So here, the who is polled, as you can see, it's showing at the very bottom. So you can see what it says. But it also says at the top, incomplete registrant, NAF coordinator will manually update the party information. So we have a third-party service provider that's pulling and parsing the who is data. If there's an error in the parsing or the pulling of the who is data, you'll be allowed to proceed, but we will be notified on the other end that the respondent information is missing. So in this case, the who is pulled, but it wasn't parsed. So we will need to go in when we do our deficiency check, and the case coordinator will need to manually enter the respondent information off of the who is record. Who is records if there's more than one. So when your complaint gets auto-generated, it's going to be generated with a missing respondent. So what will happen is after the case coordinator enters the information from the who is record, we will push a button on our screen and it will regenerate the complaint and add it into the system at that time. Oh, we've been working closely with our third-party provider, and they're ushering us that there will be significant code changes and updates for the new GTLD program to make sure that they're able to search the WHOIS and parse it as quickly and as speedily as possible and as accurately as possible after these new GTLDs enter the root. Then after you've got all the information entered for your domain names, you are able to see a summary of what you have entered. So everything that you've checked or ticked or written will show up on the screen. And again, you'll be able to, you know, glance at your documents and make sure you sent the right ones. You can back up if you didn't. You can acknowledge that the information on the page is accurate and ready to be filed. And at that point, you proceed to payment. This is just a test credit card number, so lest you be hurriedly writing that down, you're not going to get anything from that. Then you will verify that the everything you've said is accurate and true to the best of your knowledge and submit the case. At that point, you get your confirmation page, which is what you currently get for UDRP, and it's also your receipt, shows your credit card number and the authorization code. If the credit card fails, I believe the system requires you to try 2 or 3 times. But if the credit card fails, the complaint will go into our system, and you need to contact us immediately because we're going to reject that case within 24 hours if payment isn't at our office. We will contact you as well, but it would be very helpful if you contact us and say, hey, here's my filing number. You can see the filing number, the FA number on the screen here. Here's the domain name at issue. I'm trying to pay, and it didn't work, so will you help me figure out how to pay? And our case coordinators will do that. So while there's a lot of automation and self-service, the case coordinators that you're used to are still available to help if you need to call us. The way a response is filed is similar, except for the security of the respondent. The respondents are sent an email containing an encrypted link to get to their specific online filing site. So in this case, when they are served with the complaint, so they're sent the notice of complaint and the complaint itself, and in that document is a link to file the response in the case coordinator's name. Now, if a respondent tries to go online and file a response, the website will tell them, please contact a case coordinator. If you don't know who it is, go to domaindispute@adrforum.com and talk to a case coordinator. So they can go in and file a response. If a respondent simply wants to look at the documents in the case and doesn't really want to go in and file a response at this point, they just have to contact the case coordinator to get a username set up, and they can do that. And by the way, that email can be regenerated and sent to the respondent as needed if that's lost or something. Same requirements for the respondent. You can either use your existing username or you can create a new one. Again, you'll identify as either the respondent or the representative. And there's just a little information here for respondents about, whether or not they're going to have to pay a fee at the end, whether or not they're going to be allowed to respond, some options available to them. It's a little bit more sort of instruction on this page as far as what to expect in the process. Then because the response has been served in all of the languages associated with the countries in the WHOIS, those languages have been listed in our internal case management system as being possible case languages. This top drop down here will show all possible case languages. So if I had 3 domain names in a complaint, and I had 3 different registrars, one was located in the U.S., one was located in France, and one was located in Germany, then I would send service notices in English, French, and German. And the language choices at the top of this box would be English, French, and German. And the respondent would get to choose which language they were going to participate in, English, French, or German. And so then from there, the determinations, the things that the case generates would be generated in that language. They could fill in their information. Again, if you already have an account, it'll just pre-populate. So then when you get to the online filing screen, this screen shows all of the boxes that the complainant has checked and allows the respondent to click different places to see the complaint. So this is that complaint filing screen showing all the summary information that was filed against the respondent. The respondent can click and see that. The respondent can click and see the complaint itself by clicking the PDF document. And then the respondent could also click and see all of the annexes that are filed against the respondent in this document as well. So there's no need to toggle back and forth between the case portal and the online response filing site. All of the information should be available at respondent's fingertips. Additionally, you can't see it very well, but if you click at this hyperlink here, all of the defenses that the URS provides are listed for the respondent. So anything that the URS says is a defense that the respondent could raise is listed on this little pop-up so that they know it directs them to the right portion of the URS that they need to be addressing. As you scroll down, you can see that the respondent is allowed, a direct response. So respondent has 2,500 words according to the URS. So the all of the text boxes are being totaled in the aggregate. So if respondent only wants to spend, 10 of its words up on 1.2.6.1, but wants to spend a lot more time discussing 1.2.6.3, they can do that because it just aggregates the total words being entered. And then at the bottom, the respondent would upload a single file with all of its, with any annexes that it believes supports its contentions. We don't call them anything specific because for each response, those could be different. Also on this screen, it doesn't show, but the screen also allows the respondent, if you keep scrolling down, to file a claim of abuse or material falsehood. And so there's a place for that as well at the bottom of the screen, which unfortunately got cut off, I guess, of this slide. And then the same thing, the next screen just shows all the certifications that the respondent has to agree to per the URS, identify any legal proceedings, and again, the respondent also gets a confirmation. And now all of this gets uploaded immediately to the party's portal, so they can see all of this immediately on their portal as well. So the portal itself is something that we've been using for a while for UDRP. We use it for our parties and for our panelists. And we allow the users to interact with their cases. So you would enter your information, your username and your password, and you're given a dashboard. And on your dashboard, it shows up on this bottom screen, but any case with new documents will kind of show up on this screen. So you can see if you had a whole bunch of cases, for instance, with us, you can see what sort of where all the activity has been happening, where documents have been added frequently, and you can narrow the date range as well. Like I said, online filings you can do here. Respondents are directed to request their email from the case coordinator. We do have a, this new messages here, we do have a sort of a messaging system that allows parties to message one another. Nobody's used it yet, but it's actually been around for a couple years, so, feel free to use that. It does, the communication becomes part of the record. The panel will see it if you decide to use that to communicate with the other party. But because UDRP and URS requires the other parties to be copied and the panel to be copied anyway, it sort of handles that in and of itself. So you would click on My Cases, and that takes you to your dashboard. In this case, there's only one case on the dashboard, or on your case list, but there could be 30 or 40 or however many you have pending. And they are sorted by file number, but you can actually click case name, status, or due date and sort by those things as well. I don't know how many of you are aware, but we started with RES, and it also works for URS. If when you file your complaint, you enter your attorney reference number, it will perpetuate onto the letters that we send you with regard to that case. So if you have a docketing system and you want your docket number also associated with the letters that go out in the case, then you can enter that, and that will be associated as well. So you would click on the hyperlinked file number, and that would take you actually into the case itself. So for each case, you would see the case number and name, the date it was filed, the date it was commenced. It's clearly not filling in here. The status that the case is currently at and when the status ends. which type of proceeding it is. So like I said, you could have URS and RES and, you know, UDRP and ERDRP. You could have every policy could be on here. So this one tells you that this is a URS case. There are no panelists appointed in this case. And you can see who the complainant is and who the respondent is. If there's a representative, the representative's information will show up. You can also see who your case coordinator is and their email address as well. On the left-hand side, you can see all the documents in the case, and on the right-hand side is where you take action. So you can see on the left-hand side here, there's an expanded section for the different documents. You can see what's shown up. So if you're the panelist, you can see they're all sorted by domain name. All the independenceday.com domain names are lumped together so that panelists can quickly and easily look through the evidence provided. On the right-hand side, you'll see some options for case actions. In this case, I'll show you how request an extension works, but it works similarly for a stay as well. So the party clicks select, and they're offered to enter the date or select the date for their extension. And it only shows dates that are available. It doesn't let you request an extension that you can't have. And in fact, if you can't request an extension at all, it won't show up. So if an option doesn't exist on your portal, it's not available to you under the URS. And then once you pick a date, you can enter your reason for the request, and then you'll click submit. And that works that way for withdrawal, stays, and extensions. Stays are jointly requested, so either party can request the stay, but the other party gets an email saying, hey, there's a stay request in your portal. Please go online and click yes or no if you want to join it. And then we'll take that to be, on a mutual assent then if you want to join the stay. If you don't like the stays, for instance, complainant and respondent negotiated a 25-day stay, and the complainant went in and accidentally requested a 35-day stay. So the respondent says, well, hey, this isn't the stay we asked for. You can simply ignore it and it'll go away. And then you can re-request a stay after that time is up. The withdrawal, complainants can move to withdraw at any point before a final before a default determination or final, actually before the first determination. If for some reason the parties want a joint withdrawal, they can do that. And then the same process, the respondent will be told, hey, the complainant wants you to agree to the dismissal of the case or the withdrawal of the case, and then you can do that as well. We currently still approve all the dismissals, stays, and extensions, but as I was telling the IPC yesterday when I met with them, we may do away with that if we find out that it's unnecessary because there's sort of no reason as long as the parties are agreeing to these things. And as long as the rules are or the requests are within the rules, there's really no reason for us to go through and do the extra step of approving these stays. The system is validating these things as they go. And then just to show you examples of what the default and final determinations look like, they're going to look, okay, well, that didn't work. They're going to look very similar to... let's see if that works, to the UDRP decisions. They are going to be auto-generated, but they have a lot of the same features, and if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. They're available on this slideshow is available already, I think, in the Adobe room, or on the page. So you can click on that, and these are embedded in that PowerPoint presentation. And as far as the registries are concerned, the registries, in addition to getting, you know, the letter requesting the lock, et cetera, will also receive an email with a copy of the determination and instructions on what they need to do to comply with the determination. I don't have any screens for the appeals, only because the screens look really the same, and it would be very, very boring for me to re-show you some of those same screens. But I just thought I would go over quickly, you know, who can appeal, look through this slide, and then how to get an, you know, what you can get with an appeal. You can get an appeal either of the exact same documents, or you can get an appeal that allows you to submit new documents for a different filing fee. And I showed you our website at the very beginning. It's where you find links to everything you need, including this demo, which will be broken into chunks and posted on our website probably next week. And we're working right now on just finalizing some of the languages and examiner training for getting the URS up and running. I think probably I'm running out of time. So thanks to everybody, and I don't know if we're taking questions yet, Dennis, or if we're going to wait.
Yes, we're going to take questions right now. I know that there are some questions remote. And in this room, we need a microphone.
I can speak up loudly as well.
So we need it for the recording, please.
Thank you. Alex Meyerhofer, .at, backend operator for a couple of TLDs. Are you interested in doing any backend testing with backend registries, or is the communication with the backend registries not established yet? Because I understand there is a specification document that was created by ICANN recently, and I haven't seen any actual implementation of that. It's a technical question, I know,
Yeah, well, I created a registry best practices document that I think ICANN's still working on.
Yeah, we are. This is Krista with ICANN staff. We are still working on that document.
Okay.
But we will get something out.
Would you want feedback on that document? Because I saw there was an URS draft coming out recently that was with email encryption and things like that. I don't know what the name of the document was. But.
Do you remember the name of it?
I'm sorry. I'm focused on the technical.
It's quite all right.
Yeah, please send your feedback to the GTLD technical mailing list.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Christina Rosette from the IPC. Two questions. First, I'm hoping that you could give us some information as to how proxy registrations or private registrations will be handled. And second, I don't know that it matters whether you're pulling the data from the registry who is or the registrar who is. The bigger question is how is NAF going to deal with rate limiting that's being put in place by the source of the who is data?
Can you repeat the second question? I'm sorry, the echo.
Sure. I'm curious as to whether NAF is going to pull the who is data from the registry or the registrar. But the more important question is that currently many registrars put in rate limiting, which means that there's only a certain number of who is inquiries that can be accept from a particular IP address within a particular day. How is NAF going to deal with rate limiting?
Okay, so let me answer the second question first because it's a shorter answer. So currently we pull WHOIS pages for UDRP. So we do encounter rate limiting now. I mean, we work with those registrars to sign their agreements and get that rate limiting banned. But we have a third-party provider who is pulling the data for us. And as I understand it, they do direct port 43 calls to the registrars or registries. So what we find is that it's pretty accurate and we're getting most data for UDRP. The biggest question is going to be how quickly can they rebound and get all the new GTL data in their system. And because every different registrar and registry parses the data differently and passes the data differently, it's making it harder for them, but they're aware of it and working on it.
So let me just ask a follow-up. Am I correct in understanding that a URS complaint wouldn't be rejected solely because the third-party provider isn't able to quickly obtain and parse that data?
That's correct. Okay. We would do a manual pull at that point, and we would just manually go in and enter it the same way we do for UDRP, which we hope we don't have to do a lot.
All right. Thanks. And as the first question?
And as to the first question, as far as proxy providers, so the way it works right now is we are treating the we are saying that every domain name that you enter, each record gets pulled as a new respondent. So if you have more than one respondent, meaning separate WHOIS entry, you're going to have to submit a paragraph that says, these respondents are the same because, which is currently what you do under UDRP for us. When there's proxy privacy services. So we're going to take it all in, and all of that information will go to the panel, and the panel will just determine based on the WHOIS records and what you've written in that box as far as why you think they're related. The panel will determine if they really are related and if not. If they are related, your determination will go against all of those domain names. If they're unrelated, if the panel says, hey, you got five domain names, I think two are not owned by the same guy, the panel will decide, I want to make a determination against these three. These two get dismissed, file again tomorrow.
So just so that I'm clear, if under that circumstance the panel makes the determination that I've got, say I've got five domain names, mm-hmm. they're all against, the registrations are all under proxy.
Mm-hmm.
And let's make it a little bit more complicated and say it's two different proxy providers. For purposes of the discussion, the panel makes the determination that all five names are in fact related, such that it appears that it's kind of a single respondent. Will the determination then be made against the proxy provider?
Yes.
Okay.
Assuming there's two proxy providers, it would have to pick one proxy provider to go against.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Hi. Philip Corwin from Virtual Law, asking some questions on behalf of Internet Commerce Association. It should be real quick. First one, Christine, in your demo you showed for the credit card payment by the complainant a fee of $375. Is that, in fact, the fee you've set, and is there a respondent fee, a response fee?
Yes, the fee is $375 for 1 to 14 domain names. 15 to 50 is, I think, $400. It's in our fee table. The most a URS complaint would ever cost is $500, and that is with 101 or more domain names. A respondent does not pay a fee unless one of two things happens. Either the domain name or the case has 15 or more domain names, in which case their fee would match what the complainant paid, and they would not be allowed to respond unless that fee is paid. And the other situation in which a respondent could incur a fee is if there's been a default determination, and then more than 30 days have passed since the default determination, they would be required to pay what is called under the URS a reexamination fee. It's basically a fee telling the panel, yeah, you're going to have to open this case up and look at it again.
Okay.
I think there's no need to write it down because it's all on the forum's website in the supplemental rules.
Okay. Well, it's a memory aid. From the gentleman from the Asian, are you developing or have you developed a similar interface for complainant and respondents?
Thanks for the question. The ADNDLC is is honored to be selected as a URS provider, and we are currently in the process of developing online case filing and case management system, which is similar to the one as demonstrated by Christine. So hopefully it will be up and running in early October or this year. So that's the status. Yep.
Okay. For Krista, I asked in Beijing whether ICANN was developing a standard contract for U.S. providers, and ICANN, in written responses post-Beijing, said that such a contract was under development. Can you give us any idea of what the status of that is, or if it is, in fact, being developed?
Krista Papik, ICANN staff. Thanks for the question, Phil. What we have with the URS providers are memorandums of understanding, or MOUs. And those have been...
And exactly where the discussion on potential contracting for URS providers, formal contracting, I'm not sure, but I don't think it has advanced from the discussions that were held in Beijing. Then again, I would defer that to those who are actually currently involved.
Okay.
So, Phil, let me...
Yeah.
I think I know some of the answer, but not all of it, and rather than give you misinformation, let me take that down and just liaise with the legal department on that and come back.
Just let me state, I've seen the MOU, of course. I thought I made it quite clear in my question, Beijing, that I didn't consider it the same as a detailed, enforceable contract, and the response seemed to indicate a contract was being developed. So we can discuss it offline later.
No, I understand exactly what you're saying as far as MOU versus contract. But let's just, we'll get you a detailed response.
And my final question, which can be Christine or the gentleman from Asia or both, in your examiner training, I'm particularly concerned since one must prove to a very high level burden of proof that the registrant has both registered and used the domain in bad faith to lose the ERS. How are you training your examiners in regard to the presumption, if any, created by the receipt of a notice of possible infringement from the trademark clearinghouse? Because obviously, if you go on, if it's based on the trademark and you go on to register a domain for the same class of goods and services, that doesn't look very good in terms of bad faith. But if it's a completely different class, or if it's just a UDRP that perhaps was appealed or a court case in one jurisdiction. So how are the examiners going to deal with the impact of that TMCH notice on the bad faith registration element? Because I think that's a critical question.
And that is a good question. So we're basically faced with training examiners on a process that hasn't started yet, for which we have absolutely no data yet. So we've worked on, right now, we're putting together a training package that puts a lot of emphasis on that high standard of clear and convincing evidence, and that the panelists must be really, truly, firmly convinced that there was bad faith, both in registration and in use. And we're going to train them on not only the availability of the IP claims notice, but also the defenses listed in the URS and the differences between UDRP and URS. Because right now, at least with my examining panel, all of our current panelists for URS are UDRP panelists. So they're all lawyers with 15 or more years of experience, which is beneficial. Sure. And they all have done these before, but they need to be trained, I think, primarily on the differences. So they don't think this is just the same as the UDRP, repeat, rinse, repeat, rinse, repeat. So I think that's going to be evolving, and I think that as we get cases, and I have on my screen right now our decision index, our determination index, as we get public decisions, we're going to be able to fine-hone that training even more as far as what other panelists are doing and showing panelists sort of different examples of what other panelists are doing. So they're going to be able to look back immediately on other determinations and see what other panelists before them have done. So I think that'll be really helpful. But we are really starting from scratch here.
Sure. Okay. Well, thank you very much for your responses.
I have a few questions from the WConnect room. Who is the contractor that NAF is using to support its URS activities?
Hexillion.
Thank you. Next question. In the step 8 of 11 in the field trademark, you need the trademark name or number or both?
Oh, okay. So either. Oh, well, I'm sorry. No, for the top line, for trademark, you want to put the trademark name. If you want to put the number in, you can. Theoretically, in your evidence that you would submit for confirming your trademark, you would have your actual registration certificate, or it would come up in, if you have a court validated mark, it would come up in that court document. So it would be less important to have the registration number on that line because you would ideally and theoretically have it in your evidence. So mostly we need that trademark information on that line.
Next question. Are only credit card payments accepted?
At this time, yes. However, we are investigating the possibility of thinking about other sorts of payment. Because the URS is so rapid, we don't have time to wait for a check or wire transfers to clear. And so at this point, we are only doing credit card payments.
Regarding the language choice, what about the attachments?
The respondent would be able to submit attachments in the language that it elected. So in my example of English, French, and German, the pleadings would be able to be submitted in the language that the respondent elected to respond in. And English. So English is always an option. It's just if a second language is chosen, the exhibits can be submitted in that language. They could not be submitted in a third language.
Okay. And does NAF offer an API for URS submissions?
Not yet, but it's interesting that you mentioned that because we just had a business meeting about that. And if there is interest, I would love to hear about that. So, but we are currently looking into whether or not we would have some sort of an app.
That's the end of the remote participation questions. Thank you.
Chuck Gomes from VeriSign. Thanks for your presentation. My comments are going to be related to the interface for registries, though. I don't see Gustavo now, but I thank him for posting the draft URS technical requirements on the GTLD tech list, and our technical people have looked at that. Their assessment is that it's really not technical requirements. It's at too high a level, and that's probably known already, so I'm probably not saying anything that's new there. And they also don't think there's been much technical discussion about the interface with registries. And we should learn from what we've learned with the Trademark Clearinghouse and PICDRP and a bunch of other things that are where there's still work going on. So we certainly would suggest that a call be set up with registry operators and your teams, ICANN staff, et cetera, to discuss those requirements to make sure that we avoid some of the pitfalls that we've experienced in some of these other areas, like the Trademark Clearinghouse and so forth. If we collaborate together, we're going to save ourselves some time. And we're certainly willing, and I know that all registry operators and applicants are going to be willing to do that. We would say that it's really premature to cut off the discussion on the draft requirements July 23rd, because there really hasn't been any discussion, and that's awfully close. So we certainly need the high-level collaboration. We'll probably have to get down into more details, but all of us have the same goal, to make sure the interface works, to make sure that security and stability is ensured. And then last of all, a question. Will there be opportunity for registry operators to test the interface once it is up and running and we have all the requirements?
Well, I'm told I'm not supposed to get into the tech stuff too much today because this is just a demonstration, but I'll tell you that our model does not include any technological interface with the registries. We plan to conduct the interface with the registries just like we handle the registrars for UDRP, which is we'll send you an email when we need a verification on a domain name, and you can email us back. And the security around that is that we send emails from, you know, specific domain, and we ask that you set up a email account that only we know about, so you can make up some random string of characters if you want, so that you know that all the emails coming to that box are coming from us, and that you check it periodically for UDRP or URS-related communication and just reply. So it's very low-tech because it's working, and it seemed really way too complicated to try to devise some sort of an API that would work for every registry and both providers and everything else. So I'm open to sort of any sort of interface suggestions, but our model does not have any interfacing at all. It's simply just we're going to send you a polite letter and you're going to send us a polite letter back.
Thanks a lot. That's helpful. But I would still suggest that we have that call on that, and people on the GTLD tech list, and we make sure we're all on the same page and see what the needs. And you may be right, there may not be any. But let's make sure early on.
So, yeah, Chuck, it's Krista with ICANN staff. Chuck, let me liaise with Gustavo and come back to you on that.
That's great.
Perfect. Thanks.
Okay.
Hi, Christine. Following up on the question that was made about payment options, I think it would be really useful, if it's at all possible to do so, for folks to set up deposit accounts with NAF, much the same way that they do with the USPTO or with WIPO or with the clearinghouse, you know, particularly given quite candidly expected volume of these, you know, finding and how long it takes my accounting department to reimburse me. I mean, I could easily see maxing out my corporate card pretty quickly on this. Thanks.
Thank you for that suggestion.
Wendy, are there any other question on the from the remote participant?
In the URS rules dated 28 June relating to abusive complaints, there's a reference to an abuse case database that all providers will have access to. Who is building this database?
We are building and maintaining the database, but we're working together with Dennis and the AD&DRC so that it meets both of our needs, and it will just be a provider database. Our website, and I anticipated this question, so that's why this website is up. General users can go to our website and click this little tick box here for URS finding of abuse, and then click search, and all cases with a URS finding of abuse or material falsehood will show up in the search list. So that will be one way that the users will be able to search our website and find abusive cases of abuse.
Okay, then, if there are no more questions, we'll wrap up here. The PowerPoint charts that Christine used will be posted on our scheduled session, as along with the charts from AD&DRC, which has a similar screenshots of their system.
And thank you, Dennis. I just wanted to thank Christine and Dennis for being here today. Dennis Tsai and then also Dennis Chang. Olaf had to get back to the GAC meeting, but I'll just thank the what was Olaf also for making time for us, and thanks to all of you.
Yeah, thanks again. I'm really happy to be given this opportunity to share with you some latest development of AD&DRC in terms of the URS implementation, and maybe I can, I can use 3 or 5 minutes to talk about the latest update. And actually, as I mentioned earlier in responding the question, and we are still in the process in developing a similar system. And actually, the system is. Has several features, and actually we intend to provide an online system for 6 types of users. One is the complainant, respondent, and case administrator, domain name examiner, and registry operator, and URS provider as well. So all the system will serve as an online platform with function as a file sharing and publication of the examination decisions. So it will be very similar to the URS system demonstrated by Christine. So I would also like to highlight the second point is that we have already scheduled some training and conferences in terms of the URS in Asia. And what I have been scheduled, we have now planning and half-day seminar in Hong Kong, hopefully to be take place in Hong Kong in September or in October. And in November, we have another full-day conference to be held in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia, which is an annual AD&DRC conference. And before the AD&DRC one-day conference, we have scheduled a workshop on URS and UDRP panelists. So that will be the first workshop to take place in Asia in terms of the training of the URS. And we will talk about all the procedural and substantive issues at the seminar. So this is the update from my side. Maybe pass back to Mr. Chen.
Thank you, Dennis. So that was good. We still had time. This session goes to 2:15, so we're fine.
One question that I saw pop up.
Another remote. Okay, let me just check the remote site. One more question. Okay, I'll just read this one. Oh, there's...
Go ahead.
Let me just cover this online question. One more question for Christine. Will NAF require that all URS neutrals be also UDRP panelists, or this is only in the beginning of URS implementation?
It's not a requirement that the URS panelists be UDRP panelists. It was just the easy pool with which I had to draw to start with. I certainly have had a lot of interest from people who want to be on both panels, and so I'll probably be adding to the panels and then letting sort of people choose which or both if they want to be on them both.
Hi, my question is for Dennis, John Berryhill. The ADNDRC URS system, will that be independently administered by all of the separate ADNDRC offices, or will it be a single system?
Yes, thank you very much for the system. And actually, we have a current up and running system for UDRP, and it is within the filing portals are different, but the database are the same. Take, for example, all the decisions of the four offices are published in one database. So, but the case filing portal, we have four case filing portal, one for each office. So this is the how we work with the four offices. So, yeah.
Okay. Is the ADNDRC a single corporate organization, or are those branch offices owned by parties other than whoever owns the central office of the ADNDRC?
I see. That's a very good question. Allow me to give an introduction to ADNDRC. Actually, ADNDRC is a charitable institution, which is also a non-profit-making organization registered in Hong Kong in 2001. At that time, the ADNDRC was jointly established by Hong Kong International Arbitration Center and the China International Economic and Trade Arbitration Commission. So the two organizations formed the ADNDRC in Hong Kong with the aim to provide UDRP service to the region. And with the development of the ADNDRC, we have included the Korean office, the Seoul office, and the Kuala Lumpur office. And these four offices of ADNDRC are operated by four independent organizations under the Memorandum of Understanding. So that's
Like a franchise operation.
It is not memorandum of organization. It's not a franchise because it's hard to say.
I think maybe we can get offline with you if you would like to know more about the corporate structure.
Thank you.
I think I need to bring this session to an end because there's another session that's coming in right now. Okay, thank you, everyone.